So yesterday I posted a thing about Chris Lighten after listening to the latest episode of Radio Open Source and just thinking that there's this hour of audio that contains so much experience about a topic that only experience matters with is like preventing nuclear Armageddon. And he has all the right people, all the people. And what's apparent, I mean, first of all, Chris is very knowledgeable about this stuff, very knowledgeable. He talks about having read books, and there's, I can't imagine somebody reads as much as he does. And then he gets the experts, and these really are experts, to speak passionately about their expertise. I mean, they don't hold anything back, and it works. And it's just, it's like mind-to-mind stuff. And so I wrote about this yesterday, amongst many other things that I wrote about that are very heartfelt, real experiences that I've had, not nearly all of them. I mean, some of the brutality in the tech industry, it's just unspeakable what people are willing to do to have their way. And when their way is destructive, it's like, ugh, I mean, you just wouldn't believe it. and then I see Drummer kind of slipping away because, you know, and I'm trying to call the best people back and say, look, we have more work to do here. And like, you may not be aware of this, but if there isn't a quorum, if there isn't a critical mass of people using the stuff and reporting back whether it worked or didn't, whether they understood it or they didn't, and not petty bullshit. But really, seriously, I didn't understand this. And I don't understand this. But really put in the effort to try to understand it, you know? Without that critical mass, it freezes. It can't continue. I can't put out a feature without hearing back from a certain, and there's no formula for it. It's a subjective thing where I feel like confident, okay, I got it. Because some of it is the experience of having written it, and how sure were you of it when you did the software? What did I see when I tested it, you know? Sometimes you do something and like all it requires is one confirmation to know that it worked. Really be better to have five, but you could probably go ahead and document it and move on. Because the worst thing in the world is to get the, oh, it doesn't work message from a user long after you've moved on. Because you cannot hold all this stuff in your head. It has to be swapped in and out. And when you're working on it, then you understand it. When you've put it down and you've moved on to other things, you don't. And so I'm not a computer. A computer remembers perfectly, but I'm not a computer. And so that the response has to come crisply. So I just got a response saying something that I did on February 28th works perfectly from somebody who really had the problem. I know that this person had the problem that it was fixing. But you know, what if he had had a if it what if it hadn't worked perfectly? We would have been fucked. 'Cause I'm not going back. I mean, it took me a few days to swap in all that stuff to get that feature working. It doesn't take you more than, like, I don't know, a few seconds to try some of these things out. So it's like, really, people don't understand what it is to create software. And I get that. It's not their fault. But when I tell you what the realities are, you should believe me. I'm not lying to you. I'm telling you the truth. You don't understand, okay, what I have to do when I swap a project into my head and swap another one out. But trust me, it isn't something I can do. Just like at the, you know, a month later, I can't do it. It would be like starting from scratch. I try to keep notes there. You know, I tell you an example. I become friends with my eye doctor. He's about my age, very smart guy. And we chat when I go in for an exam. And so I have an unusual problem with my eyes. So he's been helping me trying to get over this. And so I had to go to his office to pick up something. And because of COVID, he came out to me instead of me going into the office. And And so he was curious about what was going on with my eyes. And I said, my God, I mean, you know all about it, right? He said, no, I don't have my notes here. And I go, yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And so I explained it to him again. But it's exactly the same thing. He doesn't remember every patient until he gets out the notes. And so, yeah, I do take notes. And by the way, I include those notes when something is open source. I include those notes in the open source release in the file called source.opml. That has the original stuff, the files that I actually work on to create the JavaScript code. And in those outlines are the notes about the code. And it's one of the very nicest things about working in an outliner. If you use Drummer, for example, you know this, that you could have 1,000 paragraphs about something, but and it can be in the middle of a very complicated piece of writing, in this case, software source code. But it only takes one line because you collapse it down. And so I have often at the top of a function, I have a thing called changes, and it's a comment. And that means it has a is comment attribute that's set true, by the way. And then underneath it, I have basically a blog for that thing, a timestamp for each set of notes that I've taken, each time I've gone in there and done something to this piece of code. And I can write as much as I want because it's all collapsed underneath that headline called changes. And, you know, even if you don't code, it's probably, and it would be an interesting experience for you to go open up one of those source.opml files and have a look inside. Because what I write in there is English. It's not JavaScript. It's English. I'm talking to another human being, probably me, or maybe someday somebody will, you know, long after I'm gone, somebody will pick up this code and wonder, what was Dave thinking when he did this crazy thing that I see? You can see a timestamp on the actual code that I'm talking about above in the changes. So you can see, well, what was he writing on this particular day? Let's go up to the changes section and see. And there it is. There's the notes that say, okay, this is... Because when you look at the code, you can't tell what the guy was thinking. It's just the code. And I once had a programmer that I worked with who said a bunch of them said comments are for sissies. They thought it was funny. I didn't think it was funny. I told them, I don't ever want to hear you say that again. So they would say it all the time. Assholes. I loved them, though. They were still assholes. One guy said, yeah, well, I don't write comments because that's job security. Oh, thanks a lot. He couldn't work on his code. Nobody else could work on his code. It was garbage. Anyway, how did I get so distracted? So, yeah, there's Chris Lydon, right? And Doc Searles read all my stuff. And in there was the thing saying, hey, you got to read. You got to listen to Chris Lydon. And furthermore, I say, look, you have to, you don't have to, but one day a week, don't listen to Rachel Maddow. Instead, listen to Chris Lydon and his guests. Chris is a good interviewer because it's not him that you listen to. It's his guests. And Mary McGrath, who I've also known for, I've known Chris for, I don't know, God knows, a lot of years. I wanted to, and why I picked up the thing was I wanted to explain a little bit of the history of how podcasting, how Chris Lydon came to be one of, this is why I picked it up, believe it or not, picked up the phone to talk through this podcast, is how did Chris Lydon come to be one of the pioneers of podcasting? Because that is true. Chris and Mary, let's not forget Mary, because she's the invisible part of Chris Lydon. Chris Lydon's the front man, but Mary McGrath is also an equal contributor. She goes everywhere with Chris. And she's, well, often, anyway. So there's Mary and Chris. And so this is what happened. Why I went to Harvard in 2003. And I basically barged in there. It was like, yeah, there was some interest in having, in using the latest technology to communicate on campus. There was some interest in that. But yeah, anyway, so why did I want to go to Harvard? I wanted to go to Harvard because the blogosphere, which was still very early in 2003, was attracting, it was growing and it was interesting, but it wasn't attracting people with great expertise. Enough people. I wanted more. I wanted all those brilliant minds in Cambridge, Massachusetts to have blogs. And I wanted, because I wanted to learn from them and I wanted to create something for those people. I wanted those people as users. And I wasn't looking to make money from them. I was looking to get their minds involved, because that's what I felt the potential was for this technology. I didn't conceive of it as being like, you know, TikTok or, you know, or YouTube or whatever. It's not what I do. I'm not saying that I don't love those things. I do. And they're very much of the same spirit, but that's not what I was doing. I was looking for the experts. And, you know, so I basically did a sales and PR campaign there and an outreach program. And we had every Thursday evening, we had a meeting in a conference room that was open to anybody that wanted to come. Didn't matter. You didn't have to be part of Harvard. You could be just from the neighborhood. And a fair number of people that were not affiliated with Harvard came and participated equally. Nobody, there was nothing. I mean, it was just a group of people. And you know, it was one of those things is that the activity is defined by who shows up. But at the same time, I made the rounds of, there are a lot of campus publications and user groups and things like that. And I gave talks anywhere that I could, and I had one-on-one meetings. And what I learned is that getting their ideas out there wasn't really a problem for the average Harvard professor. And so that wasn't a compelling, you know, here I was doing my, you know, my sales campaign basically on the community. And I had overestimated the value of the service I could provide to these people, or at least, I mean, they all blog now, okay? But this was still early, and you had to overcome the most basic objections. So, no, they say, well, I can publish anytime I want. I don't need you. They were right. They didn't need me. So whoever showed up, and one of them was Chris. And Chris, God bless him, was there almost every Thursday night. And he was like a, I don't know, he was like a very zealous, curious undergrad. Maybe even, I mean, in terms of technology, I mean, Chris has a big mind, okay? But he has a line in there that a lot of people have that they've decided that this stuff is hard. And this is an impossible line for them to cross. So they just stay on one side of it and they just say, I don't understand that. And it's too bad, because actually sometimes I think that the stories that Chris covers on his podcast could use a little bit of depth of understanding. I'm understating things, by the way. Not in the case of this nuclear war stuff. Absolutely. They do not need to know about social networks for that. It isn't, at least I hope not, something that is determined on social networks. This is the kind of thing, and they talked about this in the last episode, is that, you know, nuclear weapons are incredibly undemocratic, and you don't want them to be democratic. You don't want there to be a vote today. If there was a vote today in the United States on whether or not we should nuke Russia, yeah, it might pass. The consequences wouldn't be part of the formula. Yet you absolutely have to have the consequences as part of the determination of whether or not you push the button, you know? So it isn't democratic, and it is an elite thing. And that's why, you know, and this point was made yesterday. Well, it wasn't yesterday, actually. They did it last Thursday. I listened to it yesterday. They made the point. That's why the only thing to do with these things is to eradicate them because they are unmanageable, because they're going to destroy us sooner or later. So anyway, so we opened the door and this is who walked in, and I got what I wanted. That's the point I wanted to make. So then I went to Harvard with this idea that let's go get the great minds of the tech industry, not the tech industry, excuse me, of everything but the tech industry involved in disseminating knowledge and letting us know what they think, making that something we all can access. We won. We succeeded. We had to adapt in order to do it. It wasn't the thing that we produced that did it. That was the funny thing about it. And it's why it wasn't so obvious at first how well we had succeeded. It was take what you've done and adapt it to radio, which is, and that's where Chris and Mary come in. Why? Because their product was radio. And just for luck, they also happened to be at Harvard at the time. This was the great thing about Berkman in those days, Berkman Center for Internet and Society. It's now called the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. At the time, it was part of Harvard Law School. And they collected people like Chris and myself and Doc Searles and lots of other people. And, well, I mean, it was a fun place to be, and the minds were very active, and these were people who often got in trouble, which was fine, didn't bother me. People who get in trouble are good people, actually, often. Most people don't like them, but that's fine. But and Chris was in trouble, and that's why he was there. He had, I don't remember the details, but he had said something or done something that offended somebody at one of the public radio stations. I mean, I was delighted to meet Chris. To me, Chris, when I first met him, it was like, felt like the least likely thing, because I had heard his voice many times as an NPR listener. And I feel that Chris actually defines the NPR voice. People may not even know that it's Chris's style that they're mimicking because it's been interpreted over so many generations. But now he's got one of these mellifluous, I think that's the right word, anchor voices, radio voice. It's fun to go to dinner with Chris because I used to joke about this, and obviously I still am, is that going to dinner with Chris was like having dinner with NPR. Because he just talks that way. He's like Ted Baxter on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. I'm sorry, Chris. I say this with great love and admiration. So I want to say this, that, and I said this to Doc just now, and I want to amplify it a little bit. A lot of the I don't know, I've become unrepressed recently. And so maybe you can see that in my blog. I mean, I don't suppress things that much anymore. I don't see why I should. I mean, we're on the brink of nuclear war, right? Any day could be all of our last day. We're still not doing the right thing with COVID. It's crazy. We should be experts at COVID by now. We should be absolutely, totally expert. And we should be declaring it over. It ain't over. Okay, it's not over. They're having lockdowns in Chinese cities right now. In Europe, it's on the increase. I just got a note from the Ulster County something or other, health department or whatever, saying you better watch out because we're seeing an increase in the number of COVID cases. I'm not surprised. This thing ain't over yet. Yet Congress, amazingly, maybe this would be something Chris does in one of his next podcasts, is Congress has declared it over, and they're not funding treatments and testing. And that is that's not just fucking lunacy. That should be illegal fucking lunacy. That should be impeachment level fucking lunacy. That should be, get those assholes out of there. They aren't doing their fucking jobs. This isn't time to be saving money. This is time to be digging in, getting our trenches going, because the enemy is not defeated. What makes you think the enemy is gone? It's not. The enemy's there. But at the same time, they're allocating tens of billions of dollars for Ukraine. This is the same damn pattern we were in with Iraq. There were whole campaigns in presidential elections where they were arguing about what's good for Iraq. We're just going to do what's good for Iraq here. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I'm saying, no, your job isn't to do what's good for Iraq. Your job is to do what's good for us, for Americans. You know? This is the same party that says America first. Notice they don't say Americans first. Wouldn't that be something? Because that's not accurate. That's not what they believe in. They believe in America first, and if you ask them what's America, they would go, "Well, I'm America. That means I go first." And who am I talking about? I'm talking about the people who bought our political system, whoever they may be, the ones who own the politicians. That's America. When they talk about America first, that's what they're talking about. They're not talking about Americans first. They are hoping you assume that they're talking about that, but that ain't what they're talking about. Still doing the same damn thing. Anyway, so I said to Doc, Doc, man, we ought to be lifting Chris up. We ought to do more of that and ought to be more systematic. We ought to make sure that more people are listening to this. Because this is really good stuff. And unlike the bedtime stories you get from CNN and MSNBC, MSNBC is garbage. The only show on there right now that's any good is Lawrence O'Donnell, believe it or not. I just don't think Lawrence O'Donnell is all that great, but at least he's worth watching. I think the rest of them, over their heads, 10 times over their heads. Even as journalists, they're over their heads. And journalists generally are always over their head. But these people are completely stripped. They don't have any idea what to do with the current situation. And they haven't for a long time. They've managed to make something boring that is calamitous. It isn't anything but boring, but it just requires that you change the story every so often because the story does change. How many times do I need to be told that Donald Trump is a liar? Look, we caught Donald Trump lying. Yeah, that's like saying I drove to the grocery store and didn't have an accident. It's not news. That's when Donald Trump talks, Donald Trump lies. Who cares? Donald Trump is not an issue anymore. Maybe later he'll be an issue. Possible. Let's hope not. But right now, I don't give a shit what Donald Trump is lying about now. It's not an issue. It's not in my way. It's not in anybody's way. So let's lift each other up. That's the point. Don't stop fighting for what you're entitled to, and let's figure out what's the smart thing for people to be, you know, who's doing good work and who is treating their users fairly, their customers, their readers, their viewers, whatever you want to call it. And who isn't like destroying, who's creating, and let's lift them up so we can get out of this crazy childish world that we've been living in. Okay, thanks for listening.